You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, September 27th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hello, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
Bob has the night off. He is busy getting his haunted maze, corn maze, ready for Halloween.
Fright night.
Fright month for Bob. It runs out the whole month of October. So he's obviously scrambling to get last-minute stuff ready.
Well, he's been working on it. They work on it for at least 4 months in.
Oh, yeah. He was in the summertime putting this together.
Yeah. He's insane.
I mean, well, we all know that, yeah.
Now, come on, guys. Honestly, this year, it's beyond kick-ass. We actually built a haunted house. So it's kick-ass.
That's very cool.
Maybe we should do a show from the haunted house. That would be interesting.
That would be kind of funny.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
All that screaming in the background.
So, Rebecca, you have some big news for us tonight?
Oh, wait, yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned this because I almost forgot. What? I won the NPR Public Radio Talent Quest.
Yeah!
Awesome.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
High fives all around.
Yeah, I was I was one of the three of the remaining five people who have won $10,000 and the additional resources we need to create a pilot episode of a show. We will create the pilot by December, pitch it to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and if all goes well, then they will decide to throw money at me to continue making shows, which will, of course, have a skeptical bent to them.
Good. Awesome. Better you than Bill Moyers. Take it out of this fun.
Excellent.
Now, yeah, there's a weird little magic thing attached to this. I actually predicted this.
Did you?
I did.
Are you going to win $1 million off of this?
No, but I did tell you from the very beginning. If you were in a room with me, I would be looking you dead in the eye. But I did say to you very matter-of-factly, Rebecca, you're going to win this.
You did. You did say that. And I have to say that the reason why I won is due entirely to you guys and to the listeners of the podcast here, the readers of the blog. I won by popular vote. And if I hadn't have won the popular vote, I do not think that I would have won. So it was huge. You guys, they were telling me the results the other day to let me know I had won, and they said, they told me that I drove so much traffic to the site that if they do it again next year, they want me to do their public relations. Because
nice.
You're doing something right.
Skeptics were basically running that website for the last 3 months or
I know, but Rebecca, yeah, it is definitely in part due to our audience and all that. But, you know, honestly, you have a lot of cred, you know, like it's you.
Yeah, if you didn't have the chops, you wouldn't be there, right?
Thanks. Well, I'm pretty excited. I can't wait to get going on the pilot. And, I don't know, more exciting things to come. I'm sure I'll keep everybody updated as that goes along.
Yeah, so. It's exciting.
Very it's going to cool. be cool as hell. Come on.
Always more and better things. Yep.
That's right.
And we're there to help.
Yeah, it's always good to know another famous person, you know?
Well, and of course, I do plan on sticking with the Skeptic's Guide.
You better.
Yeah, right?
Well, you know.
We'll have to find you.
We've had some listeners express concerns, but no, I have no plans to leave. That's true.
Well, Rebecca, you know, look, if you get too famous, you're going to have to move on, of course, but we'll be kicking and screaming at your door.
No. If I get too famous, I'll be dragging you guys along with me. You'll
All right,
be
that sounds good.
Riding packing, my coattails.
Packing my bags.
I will absolutely become part of your entourage.
Excellent.
It's going to happen.
Do I have to call you Miss Watson?
You do anyway, don't you?
Oh, that's right, Miss Watson. I forgot.
Miss Watson.
congratulations again, Rebecca. That's wonderful news. A quick plug. I was on the Line One radio show out of Alaska a couple days
Alaska
ago.
Alaska has radio shows?
Apparently. Yeah.
That's why the moose grow the big horns the way they do. Big antenna
so
they can pick up.
Guys, my wife is from Alaska, so retract all that. Steve, please don't put that in the show.
I'll edit it all out, Jay.
That's
worry.
Right. There are no moose in Alaska.
Honey, don't worry. They're just joking.
Is it mooses or meese?
It's meese.
It's Musilix.
Oh, and wait, there was a radio station on Northern Exposure. So, never mind.
That's true. So, you're right. So, they must have one.
That was ham radio.
I saw it on TV, so it must be true.
Very, very quickly, this is a listener, Thad Woodward, who's a doctor who runs a medically-oriented news show in Alaska called Line One, and he's very skeptical. He gave me an incredibly softball interview. I mean, he really knew where my sweet spot was, asked me just, like, totally set up skeptical questions. But it was great. It was a good talk. It was an hour-long show. We had a good time. So, thanks, Thad.
Cool, Steve. I can't wait to hear it.
Well, I think it was live. I don't know if it's recorded.
There's something on.
It's out in outer space right now. You have to go get it there.
Oh, never mind then.
The first news item is an acupuncture study. Now, we had a ton of email on this, so this was definitely making the rounds. And I get a lot of questions about acupuncture. That's one of those alternative modalities, so-called alternative modalities, where people, even skeptics, say, yeah, but what about acupuncture? Does this work? Because there's some sliver of plausibility here. Something's actually happening. You know, needles are being stuck into the body. What about that? And there was a German study where they looked at three groups, people with chronic lower back pain who had never received acupuncture before and did not have surgery. And they treated one group with standard medical treatment, which was mainly some like aspirin-like drugs, anti-inflammatories, maybe some physical therapy. And then two acupuncture groups, one with so-called real acupuncture, what they called verum acupuncture or true acupuncture, where they actually put them in the places where they're supposed to go, and they had a certified acupuncturist use the traditional Chinese diagnostic methods to figure out where the needles were supposed to go. And then they had sham acupuncture, where they had the acupuncturist put the needles into non-acupuncture locations and not put them in deep enough so that they get stuck into the chi. You know, you have to go down to a certain depth before the needle hits the flowing chi, which is the life energy that is allegedly manipulated by acupuncture. And they weren't manipulated. They weren't twisted or anything or palpated once they were inserted. So that was the sham acupuncture. And this is a large study, 1,100 people. And what they found was that after 6 months, 47% of the true acupuncture group noted a certain amount of improvement, 44% of the sham acupuncture and 27% of the standard therapy group. Now, the press is presenting this study as acupuncture works, right? Which always drives me crazy. It's like saying, you know, a study which shows that some specific surgical procedure is effective for some specific indication, saying surgery works.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever, you know. The chiropractors do that too. Chiropractic works. No. This study suggested that this specific manipulation worked for this specific indication within the parameters of the study. So that's one thing. But also, they missed a lot of the real implications of the study. First of all, there was no difference between the real acupuncture and sham acupuncture groups. And this is very consistent with the vast majority of the literature on acupuncture. It turns out that when you look at all the evidence, it doesn't matter where you stick the needles. So that supports the scientific idea that, you know, there is no chi, there is no life, mysterious, unmeasurable, spiritual life energy that's flowing through these lines in the body. That's all pre-scientific, superstitious nonsense. And all the empirical evidence, all the research basically bears it out. And this study bears it out as well. It doesn't matter where you stick the needles. So, you know, the press could have just as well said that study shows acupuncture doesn't work, right? Or that the entire theoretical basis for acupuncture is wrong. But there was this pretty marked difference between the both of the acupuncture groups and the standard therapy group. So the question is, well, just does sticking needles in the skin, does that have some kind of muscle relaxation or maybe anti-inflammatory, whatever, some kind of a beneficial effect for chronic lower back pain? And I think this study's not enough to really conclude that that is the case, because there were still some variables that weren't being controlled for here. First of all, people knew if they were getting acupuncture or not. It wasn't a double-blind study. So the introduction of a novel treatment can generate a placebo effect. And when we're talking about pain, especially back pain is in fact increasingly being recognized as a huge psychological component to it. And just the level of stress, for example, that people have can certainly affect their perceptions of their lower back pain. So it's one of those disorders that where for which there is a very large placebo effect. So you got to be especially careful with those kinds of disorders when you're studying them in this way. And this was not double-blinded because people knew if they were getting acupuncture or not, even though they didn't know if they were getting quote-unquote real versus sham acupuncture.
That seems huge, though,
the,
you know?
Yeah. The other problem with that, I mean, immediately when I read the study, the 27% seemed really low to me. But, of course, it depends on exactly, you know, what their threshold was and what their measures were. But I did look around. I mean, I think I need to dig a little bit deeper and see what other people are saying about this. But from what I found, most other studies have the standard therapy or the natural history of back pain is better than 27% improvement at 6 months. So, I mean, I think that would open up the door even further for a possible placebo effect if the standard group was not really being treated very well or was not getting a terribly good outcome. And if you recall from last week, we discussed this study about how most medical literature is wrong. And I put that in context of you can't really interpret a single study. You have to interpret a literature and how the literature evolves over time. So what I would conclude from the acupuncture literature is, first of all, we can dispense with the whole notion of qi and acupuncture points. I think that's been empirically really destroyed.
What
by
they call them, meridian points? Is that
yeah, meridians and the lines of the flow of the qi. But there is still this remaining question about, is there something physiological happening just from sticking these needles, you know, through the skin and into the muscles that could be having some physiological effect that could have some symptomatic benefit in certain situations? And I think there the literature is not compelling. There's a lot of noise and there's a lot of mixed results, and it's not really building to a consensus, is my impression. A lot of reviews and meta-analyses have been either wishy-washy or negative.
You mean, Steve, like if you put a needle in the body, it might release a chemical of some kind in reaction to that?
Well, sure. It might cause the release of endorphins. There's a phenomenon known as counter-irritation, where if, you know, like if you bang your elbow, what do?
Rub it.
You rub it.
Cry.
The rubbing, yeah, if you're not a girl, if you're a guy, you rub it.
Not a girl or Jay.
Or Jay. Yeah.
Nice.
It's a little crying. It's, you know. So get back to the rubbing. What are we rubbing now?
Your elbow, if you even hurts.
Oh, the elbow.
So the rubbing is activating other sensory pathways, which will then diminish the painful sensory pathways.
Is that like scratching an itch?
Sort of. Not quite, but sort of. So that's another possible mechanism that might be having some temporary symptomatic benefit, you know, to sticking the needles in. But again, hasn't really been clearly established that that's a significant enough effect that it's worthwhile doing this. Also, I pointed out, I blogged about this today, I pointed out that other stuff happens during an acupuncture treatment other than the needles getting stuck through the skin. You know, patients will often lay down on a table, they're encouraged to relax, there's often a music playing in the background in a pleasant environment, maybe incense. So there's a whole relaxation component to it that certainly could have a symptomatic benefit in lower back pain that's due partly to muscle tension. And that was not controlled for in this kind of study. The bottom line is we still need better design studies before we can sort this out. And there's a lot of noise in this literature. So I'm not convinced at this point for this subset question of whether or not there could be some symptomatic benefit from just sticking needles somewhere, you know, in the afflicted area or in the body for acupuncture. So it's kind of a complicated question. Unlike homeopathy, where you could say it's 100% nonsense, it's water, there's nothing to it, literally. You have to be a little bit more qualified with acupuncture because there is something physical going on.
Well, Steve, I've read a lot about acupuncture over the years, mm-hmm. and you know, you said earlier in the beginning when you were talking, you were saying that there's a sliver of something there that could have an effect. But if you take acupuncture for what it's really talking about, it's actually talking about directing energy into the meridian points, correct?
Typical energy medicine kind of stuff.
So would you draw a parallel here to that in chiropractic? Like, okay, there's, you know, chiropractic may have like a muscle relaxation benefit that some people could detect, but I don't really think acupuncture has anything like that. There really
isn't. I do think it's very analogous to chiropractic in that way, that the underlying theory is this energy medicine. The chiropractors have the innate intelligence that's they're freeing up the flow of that, and and acupuncturists are freeing up the flow of qi. But if you dispense with all of that and you look at just what's happening physical, okay, maybe manipulation causes some temporary muscle relaxation that could have some symptomatic benefit. Maybe there's some counter-irritation or endorphin release or something going on with the acupuncture needles that might have some temporary symptomatic relief. So it's very, very similar. But unfortunately, the real physiological scientific questions are buried in an avalanche of this superstitious nonsense and all kinds of pseudoscientific claims for the medical applications of these, whether it's using chiropractic to treat asthma or ear infections or whether it's using acupuncture to cure cancer. You know, that's the stuff we have to get rid of that stuff first.
My father, he served in the Korean War, 1950-51. And when he was there, he went and saw an acupuncturist who told him that he could get him to stop smoking due to the acupuncture. And sure enough, didn't work.
There's a literature on smoking cessation with acupuncture, and that is pretty negative. So the studies for that and also with drug addiction are pretty negative. The next news item deals with a teacher who was fired, he claims, for saying that the Bible isn't literal. This takes place. This is a story of Steve Bitterman, who's 60 years old, who worked at the Southwestern Community College, and he teaches a course in Western civilization. And he uses the Old Testament of the Bible in his class and uses it as a work of literature, as a way of understanding the Jewish people, for example. And he talks about it as if the stories in the Old Testament are mythology, are fables, are not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he discusses it in the context of his course. Now, he was recently fired, and he claims that that's a violation of his free speech and that he was fired because the students complained that their faith in the literal interpretation of the Bible was insulted by this class. That's his claim. The college, so far, has said that's not true. He was fired over personal reasons. So that's all the information that we have at this point in time. We'll have to see how this story develops. But you know, we do talk when these news items come up about this conflict between freedom of speech, academic freedom, and the rights of the university to control the quality of the content that teachers are teaching in their school, in their university or college. And this is sort of turning it the other way. We've spoken about, you know, professors who support the 9/11 conspiracy theories or other ideas about 9/11 or maybe want to teach historical revisionism like Holocaust denial. And we've come down pretty firm on the side of saying, yep, the university has the right to fire or silence somebody who is teaching something that's so anti-intellectual and made up, you know, like the Holocaust never happened. This is an interesting one. You know, this is interesting. I think that if the way he's characterizing his class is accurate, I mean, I don't know what kinds of things he actually said in the class, I only know what's now being reported. That all sounds perfectly legitimate to me, well within the bounds of academic freedom. And it also sounds like the kind of thing that a fundamentalist student would absolutely complain about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's very plausible.
Well, the thing that doesn't make much sense to me is that, you know, he does go into, if you read the article, he does go into detail about what happened. You know, he just says, you know, these are the things that I'm teaching, and then he makes comparisons like, you know, if a science teacher teaches a scientific fact, they're not going to get fired, but he's saying, you know, he was teaching what he considered to be a scientific fact, and then,
right.
And he did get fired. And then the school comes back and says, well, believe me, we understand the freedom of speech rights of our teachers, but you know they don't want to comment on this particular case. I think the school would say, you know, these are the grounds in which we're firing him under this auspice because he's making claims that he's being fired for one thing and the school has something else. You know, why would they hide it? Why wouldn't they just say we're firing him because of this?
Yeah, I don't think we're getting the whole story right now. And the article that I read said that Linda Wild, who was the vice president of academic affairs at Southwest, fired him over the telephone, did not give him a specific reason, and that she was not returning phone calls or emails to the reporter. So she's not talking to the press, at least that I could find, at the current time. By the time this podcast goes up, this story may have already developed further, but that's what we have right now. Just let me just read you one last quote from Bitterman at the end of the article. He says, as a taxpayer, I'd like to know if a tax-supported public institution of higher learning has given veto power over what can and cannot be said in its classrooms to a fundamentalist religious group, he said. If it has, then the taxpaying public of Iowa has a right to know. I certainly agree with that. But playing devil's advocate, I'm trying to think, could there possibly be any legitimate beef that the school has with this guy? And I suppose if he were teaching religious faith in the guise of history of Western civilization, even if that faith was atheism, meaning he's teaching, you know, that God does not exist. I mean, he was teaching that as part of the course rather than saying, you know, in the context of history, this is how we would interpret this or of literature. And that could be a subtle distinction, but you know, you can teach the facts, you can teach the history or the literature or the science without saying overtly, making faith-based statements overtly. So it'd be interesting to see if this plays out, if that's what the accusation was, that he was making some kind of comments that were not in the realm of history or literature, but that were in the realm of faith, even though they were in the negative. And if that's the case, would that be a legitimate case against him? What do you guys think about that?
I think it's flimsy at best.
Yeah.
I know. And I think that the school would have come out and said that that's why, if that was the reason.
Yeah, perhaps.
If he was tenured, it takes a long, you know, usually takes a process to get rid of a teacher.
He couldn't have been tenured and fired over the phone. I mean, tenure is a process. You're right. So I don't. And the article makes no mention of that.
Yeah, there just simply isn't enough information. But I think what you said is plausible, Steve. It just depends. What class specifically is he teaching? What tone was he teaching? That particular things that upset people or supposedly upset people. There's too much unknown here.
Right. I mean, at this point, it's more of a hypothetical. So could he have said anything that would be legitimate?
If any listeners are interested in hearing more about that topic, though, about treating God as a literary character, sort of, because that's what he was doing, right? Jack Miles wrote a great book called God, a Biography, and won the Pulitzer, and it's really a fantastic read. So highly recommend that.
The next news item is interesting. You know, it's a rare event when I see a news item that I really can't decide if it's true or not, and it takes me a while to really wrap my mind around it and decide if I think it's real. This one is interesting. The title is Boy Survives 2-Hour Flight to Moscow Hanging on to Plane Wing. This is a story of a 15-year-old boy from the Urals who stowed away on the outside of a Boeing 737, and after a 2-hour flight with the jet going at 500 miles an hour at 30,000 feet, with a wind chill estimated at negative 58 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, man.
Negative 50 degrees Celsius.
Jeez.
The plane landed, and he collapsed onto the tarmac, and, of course, was rushed to the hospital. So my initial reaction was, now, wait a minute. You know, first of all, there's no way this kid was hanging onto the wing, you know, at 500 miles an hour. That's just not possible. I found another report, this one in Pravda. And the Pravda report had some quotes from the boy. And
I saw clouds.
He says that he climbed into the wing, which I'm not sure what he really meant by that, and that he sat on top of a tire. It might mean that he actually crawled up into the landing gear.
Yeah,
he was
that's
inside
what that
the
means.
Landing gear. Now, so that lends at least a layer of plausibility to this.
Yeah, he wasn't like holding on with his fingernails.
Right.
On
most
the
people they've
wing.
Found who have done that though have died. They
that's
haven't
right.
survived it.
That's right. There are reports of people doing that, hiding up in the landing gear, and then they typically freeze to death.
Well, it only went 808 miles, which to a jet. They can cover that really quickly.
Well, it's 2 hours. They said 2 hours.
2 hours.
That's a
lot
of time.
That's a long time.
It's a long time. And then, you know, 30,000 feet sounds like a lot, too, but that's just a little bit higher than the peak of Mount Everest.
30,000 feet, though, you know, it's like no,
go unconscious
almost
at that
no
point,
oxygen, right? I mean, how much can you breathe outside of 30,000? I thought 10,000 feet was the limit.
The oxygen tension was about 30% of what it would be at sea level. Well, Jay, people can survive on the top of Mount Everest without oxygen. People have climbed to the top of Mount Everest with no oxygen. But they're acclimated, and they're physically fit, and they take weeks and weeks to get their bodies acclimated to that altitude. But then again, they have to be there for a long time. He was unconscious the entire flight, so he was not that. Again, that's another layer of plausibility and I don't think he would be conscious, and he didn't regain consciousness until after the plane landed. There's also reports that he has severe frostbite. They think they're going to have to amputate both of his hands because of the extreme frostbite that he suffered. So the details are actually starting to make more sense over time, and when you actually ask the questions like, what would the oxygen be? How high is that? How cold was it? It's right at the edge, I think, of plausibility.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out that that there was some different elements to the story, that what we're hearing is not true. But I guess I could buy it if it turns out to be true with the way the elements are moving in a more plausible direction. You know, he was in the landing gear. He was unconscious the whole time, you know. He had the frostbite.
Yeah, you're right, Steve. It's right on the edge. And what about pictures? And you know, in today's day and age, it's usually pictures. There was no pictures.
Well, there's a picture. I see a picture of a kid on an operating table surrounded by surgeons, but who knows who the hell that is? I mean, it's not authenticated by what's in the picture itself.
You know, I suppose if they sent us his hands, you know, there'd be a little more to it.
What's the motivation to, say, faking a story?
Well, but we know there are urban legends. There are fake stories like this all the time. They crop up. They get whatever. They get reported because they're fantastic.
News articles?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yes. Newspapers report fake stories all the time, and they bury their retraction, you know, deep somewhere in the middle, you know, days later. Oh yeah. You know all those stories. The finger in the chili, or the rat
that was
and
fake?
The chicken. All those things turn out to be fake, but they get reported credulously by the press all the time. So I have no trouble believing that a story like this could be fake or grossly distorted and still being propagated through the press. I don't have a problem with that. But typically there's the red flags. It's the friend of a friend, right? It's the second hand. They usually do not name people by name, give specific references or details that could be checked out. This one says what the airport was. It gives the kid's actual name. Andre, you know, it says which hospital he went to. So it's giving more details than the typical urban legend story gives. So I don't know. I if I had to put my nickel down at this point with what I've been able to discover, I would say that this is an amazing but true story. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Well, let's go on to your questions and emails. The first question comes from Bruce Botello Jr. from Rhode Island in the United States. And Bruce writes, "Let me begin by saying I love the podcast. In fact, it's the only podcast I download and listen to every week."
That's cool.
"My girlfriend and I watched the new television show Mansers on the Spike Network. This show claims to answer the most important questions to guys. The featured question was whether party girls, athletic girls, or smart girls are better in bed. Unfortunately, I can't find anything along the lines of citation, so I can't confirm if what they claimed is true. However, there was a doctor discussing a study. In this study, it was determined party girls generally think all they have to do is show up for sex and their job is done. Athletic girls generally view sex as a recreational and competitive activity, and smart girls are generally more comfortable with their sexuality and ultimately better in bed. I am sorry to ask you to open this veritable Pandora's box of more worship and attempted wooing of the lovely and intelligent Rebecca, but I was wondering if you had any knowledge of this or other studies done like this. Plus, I thought it was something all of you, especially Rebecca, would enjoy hearing, and it gives me hope for the future when a network boasting it's the first network for men comes right out and tells men intelligent women are more desirable."
Wow. That is a nice thing to hear, I guess.
Where do we sign up for this study?
Yeah, really, that's what I wonder. And I mean,
you're two of those.
Yeah. No, I believe I'm all three. Which two did you think I was?
Party girl and smart girl.
Oh, okay. Well, I also play football every week, so does that make me an athletic?
And you do ride your bike to your job.
And I ride the bike every day, and I used to play roller derby, so I'm pretty sure that puts me... Oh, and I played on softball, too.
And you pole dance occasionally.
I mean, that really does classify you as one hell of a lay, Rebecca. That's you got the bed cred, baby.
But it wouldn't qualify you for the study, because there's too many variables.
So for the study, I'm wondering, did girls have to say I'm one or the other? Because I mean,
I'm a party girl.
Right, I'm an athletic girl.
I'm an athletic
I'm a smart girl.
You
know.
Or did the guys sort them by type?
Yeah, I don't know. I looked on PubMed to see if I could find anything that bared even a passing resemblance to this, and I really couldn't.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything either. Yeah,
but I can classify women into these three classifications just by fondling their breasts for 10 minutes.
Because the athletic ones are the ones who give you the black eye.
I have my own mechanism of finding out.
The smart ones are the ones who already had the restraining order ready to go.
You know, the Spike Network is not exactly the Discovery Health Channel here.
That's interesting, though.
Even playing fields here.
So the first thing that strikes me about this claim, first of all, is that to whatever degree this may be true for women, it's 10 times as true for men. I mean, the smart guys are far and away the best in bed. I mean, there's no question.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so how many smart guys have you slept with?
Oh, too many to count, really.
Okay.
Just myself, actually.
Well,
yeah,
you know.
I'm sure that doesn't count.
Rebecca, are you refuting me on that? No, okay, we'll take your
sounds
silence.
Like
there
a dare.
We go. Yeah, she's
tacit,
like,
tacit
she
agreement.
She scrolls through the menu.
Let me see. Number 285, he was athletic, wasn't he?
Anyway.
Come on, we love you. I'm jealous. Come on, keep going. Shut up.
I noticed there wasn't a category for funny women, but that's because, as Christopher Hitchens says, women aren't funny.
That's true. There aren't any, so you don't
so there
worry
aren't any,
about
so we
don't,
that's why there's no category for that.
But, Steve, your observation was actually dead on. If you say, okay, a party guy, an athletic guy, or a smart guy, you know, I agree with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, even Revenge of the Nerds figured that out in that movie. Yeah. They said, hey, what do nerds do? They think about sex 24/7. Of course they're better at it. That's all they
and
think about.
And it was
about.
In a movie, so you know it's true.
Yeah, I mean, football jocks, what they think about football all day. They don't know what they're doing.
Jocks,
and they think they have to just show up, just like the party girls, right?
It's interesting. Yeah. It's funny.
It's
funny.
Little pops, you know, cultural, social psychology. It's fun, but I don't think we'll have the definitive answer to that anytime soon.
No, but we will conduct the breast fondling tests whenever women are prepared. Just bring them in.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I saw Jay's budget for that, by the way. It includes, what was it, like $20 per lap dance? Was that what you were budgeting for that, Jay?
Yeah, and a pack of gum. It's all good.
All right, the next question comes from Ian Byrne in Sydney, Australia. And
hello,
he writes,
Ian.
Blimey.
Sorry.
Love the show. Your cut to the quick approach to questions. I would be very interested to hear your thoughts on the practice of taking colloidal minerals as a dietary supplement with its reportedly extensive health benefits. And then he gives us a reference below. I also confess that I have been a regular consumer of these minerals, so at worst, if you burst my bubble, you will also save me some money. We also got a second email with the same question, this one from Warren Mahey in New Zealand. So I guess down under, New Zealand and Australia, they're having a lot of problems with the colloidal minerals. Well, here's my cut to the quick approach. It's all nonsense. There's no proven benefit to the colloidal minerals as supplements, and they've actually have been studied. Actually, Warren provides a link to Quackwatch. Quackwatch is run by Stephen Barrett, and it's chock full of information on all sorts of dubious claims. And he has a good article about colloidal silver, risk without benefit. So a lot of times when we're talking about some so-called alternative methods or supplements, the direct physical or biological risk may be on the low side. You know, homeopathic remedies are water. There's not much biological risk there. But there's also no benefit. Here we have actual biological risk without the benefit. So it's a lose-lose situation. These colloidal minerals, like colloidal silver, actually can accumulate in some of the tissues in the body and can have, over a long period of time, you can have a cumulative toxicity from them.
Steve, what is a colloidal mineral?
It's suspended. I think they use some kind of electrical process to suspend the minerals in a solution or water so that you can consume them that way.
Okay.
Of course, the claims for it are the claims for the kind of stuff you would see for any snake oil remedy. Here, on the Quackwatch article, they have a typical ad here for colloidal silver. It says, safely stops internal and external infections, bronchitis, burns and bites, colds and flu, food poisoning, herpes, gonorrhea, meningitis, pink eye, pneumonia, ringworm, shingles, and the list goes on.
And terminal gullibility.
Well, doesn't cure the gullibility, unfortunately.
You just got to take more of it.
I actually met a woman at a an alternative medicine conference that was being sponsored by PsyCop, now CSI, and she suffered from argyria. Argyria is what happens when the colloidal silver builds up in your skin over years. And her skin was silvery gray. This woman looked like an alien. It's interesting. She had that sort of silvery gray skin color that is often attributed to the so-called gray, you know, those big-eyed aliens.
Wow, what was that doing to her kidneys and liver?
Yeah. It's not pretty. And she made the rounds at these types of conferences sort of as a living cautionary tale about the potential risks of taking colloidal silver.
Well, that's one way to take it with you, I guess.
You think she's still around today, Steve?
I have not seen or heard from her in a while, but I wouldn't necessarily know. So I don't know is the bottom line. So quick answer, it's just another form of snake oil. And an unsafe one to boot.
Righto.
Now we're going to go down under for our interview with Richard Saunders of the Australian Skeptics. So let's go to the interview now. Joining us now is Richard Saunders. Richard, welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Richard is joining us from Sydney, Australia, where he runs the Mystery Investigators. Can you just start by telling us about that?
Mystery Investigators grew out of a discussion over dinner one night at an Australian Skeptics convention. On the dinner table, there was a teacher who suggested it might be a good idea if some skeptics came to visit her school and talk to the kids about skepticism and so on. So a couple of us got together and we thought, well, we'll make it fun. We put together an hour show with water divining and all sorts of miracle claims. And I think the draw card was really a big water divining test. The school loved it so much they booked us straight away for the next year. And the people who performed, two of us, Alinda and myself, decided to form an official company. So we do now go around to schools and perform our Mystery Investigator show.
Excellent. Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. I get a huge kick out of it. In fact, just a couple of months ago, we did something like 12 shows in a row at the Australian Museum here in Sydney as part of their Science Week, and we had hundreds of kids come through. We'd give I think it was about a 45-minute show, and then we'd have a little break, and then the next room full of kids would come in, and we'd do another show. It's fantastic.
And what kind of things do you do for them?
Well, we've got, the draw card is the water divining because it shows water divining or water dowsing and the kids can test it for themselves and it explains to them how to do a double blind test in science and what that means. We also have a real bed of nails, which is the finale of the show because we always get a teacher to come down and lie on the bed of nails and the kids go nuts because it's the teacher lying on the bed of nails.
Sure.
We have a predict the future test with a game we call Heads and Tails where we toss a coin and the kids have to predict whether it's going to be heads or tails. And after about 7 or 8 tosses of the coin, there's one kid left. And then we ask all the other kids in the room now, is that kid psychic because they predicted the toss of a coin? Gets them thinking about statistics and things like that. And we do a fire walking demonstration. No real fire, of course. We just use their imagination, but we explain all about that. And we have optical illusions and endless stuff. I think the longest show we did was probably an hour and a half, and then questions, and then the kids wanted more. So it's quite successful.
What age groups do you target?
We do both here primary school, which is about 8 years old, 9 years old, 10, 11, all the way up through high school, and anybody who wants to hear us.
So you do magic as well during the show?
Oh, yeah. The show starts off with spoon bending. I mean, we have to thank Uri Geller for giving us a great shtick.
He didn't invent that.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen that trick probably 100 times, and I actually still enjoy watching it.
I enjoy doing it. And what I love about spoon bending, especially when I do it for primary school, elementary school kids, and high school kids, is most of them have never heard about it. And which helps us make the point, well, if it was real and this character in the 70s could really bend metal and spoons with his mind, it would be part of our society now. Everyone would know about it. Mm-hmm. But they haven't. But, and they think it's funny, too. They think it's great. And after the show, of course, you get a rush of children coming up, and the most thing they ask is, how did you do it? How do you do it?
Yeah.
Right, right.
And I would be one of them, too. I love asking magicians how they do it.
Now, let me ask you a question. Quickly, in Australia, do you guys spell skeptic with a K or a C?
We spell it, officially, the Australian skeptics spell it with a K. In Australian English, which is more or less British English, it's spelled with a C. And some people complain about that, and if that's all they have to complain about, we suggest they go and get a life.
Right, so you guys swing both ways.
Okay.
You don't want to piss off the UK skeptics or the United States skeptics, so you just sort of play both sides.
Honestly, it's if someone's worried about spelling color with a U in it or adding a Z here or there, it's like it's so unimportant.
So now, what's a Z exactly?
Ha ha ha!
You know, we got some American listeners out there. We got to straighten them out.
Oh, okay.
That's dead, baby.
Well, a Z is what a Z was before it evolved.
Now, you have some of this on your website. You actually have some videos online there. I saw you have one episode that I could find on your website of Mystery Investigators Online TV. Is there more on there, or is it more than the one that I saw, or do you have more coming?
There's more coming. We've got about four episodes in various processes of being edited or filmed or something like that. I just discovered... because I also do the Skeptic Tank podcast for the Australian Skeptics, that I've turned into a sort of a one-man band because I've got all the skills required to do audio editing and video filming, and I appear in them. By and by, it just gets too much, and so I have to pace myself a little bit, but I will try to put more videos up as soon as I can.
And then there's the origami, too. Let's not forget about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, just recently I've been having enormous fun... I invented an origami Pigasus, the flying pig for the James Randi. I said to James Randi when I was with him on the cruise with Rebecca that I would invent an original origami pig for him because I make origami. I've written books about it. I've stuck at it, and I came up with one. I'm delighted that people all around the world now are folding the little origami pig. It's great fun.
You invited us out to Australia, but I'm still waiting for my ticket.
Wasn't it in the post?
The QE2 will be at your door soon, Rebecca.
Hey, Rebecca, come
pick you up.
Yeah,
come on. I what did I do just earlier this month? I went all the way to Alaska.
That's true for me.
Just for you, of course.
So you were on the Alaskan cruise with the James Randi Education Foundation.
I was, and it was enormous fun. I mean, I'm so glad I went, apart from the fact that you got to speak with James Randi and really interesting people. It's just the scenery was beautiful. We had great times, lots of laughs, and good lectures.
So, Richard, let me ask you, how many times did Rebecca chum off the boat?
Chum off the boat?
Chum off the boat?
Yeah, you know.
Is this an American?
She's drinking. She's, you know.
It must be.
She's a little tipsy, walking down, and next thing you know, you're holding her hair back, and she's giving it up.
Oh, I see. She's... I didn't notice any, but Randi told me a lot of people were yelling out for somebody called Huey, who was lost overboard. They go up to the deck and say, Huey!
I was not one of them, I assure you.
You are not one of them, Rebecca, no.
Hey, Richard, obviously James Randi has Uri Geller as his nemesis in his career. Do you have a nemesis? Is there an equivalent to that for you?
Someone yeah, Rebecca.
Who, you said we were best friends forever. What happened?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's a very good question. I think they come and go in this country. We get our regular gaggle of people who claim to talk with the dead. I have been called all sorts of interesting names. I've had death threats, which has been interesting. But the funniest thing I've been called is a mouseketeer of evil.
Oh my god.
What does that even mean?
That's cool,
I thought Britney
actually.
Spears was the mouseketeer of evil.
Well, this came about because you may be familiar with Ratbag, Peter Bowditch, who runs the ratbags.com website. And he's also in the Australian Skeptics. He's very strong on the lunatics who run around telling parents not to vaccinate their children.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a talk these lunatics gave, and I was with Peter. And later on one of their bulletin boards, they referred to me, well, they referred to Peter being there and me as his henchman or the musketeer of evil. So I think that's quite good.
Yeah, I always consider those kinds of insults and labels from the other side as badges of honor, right?
I don't mind them at all. I mean, but the strangest thing was the death threat. I didn't expect the death threat. I don't think it was serious. And earlier this year, I was attacked in one of the Sydney newspapers in the editorial, which was – it really took me by surprise. I didn't know how quite to react to that. We responded on the Australian Skeptics website, but to see my name in the newspaper and being personally attacked because I dared to suggest that miracles don't happen, that was quite something.
Damn you. Awesome. So you mentioned vaccinations. How big is the anti-vaccination movement in Australia, and how are you guys doing in terms of your compliance with vaccination? Do you know?
Very good, I'm pleased to say. I mean, we've got a lot of fringe groups in this country. By and large, they don't do too well. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's something to do with the water we drink here. It's like the creationists. There's a lobby group, and they try hard, but by and large, the Australian public just don't take them seriously. I'm very pleased about that. But they try. I mean, there are a lot of parents out there who are scared into not vaccinating their children. And last year or the year before, I attended a children's and babies expo in Sydney, which is just for young parents to come along and see the latest diaper or the latest bottle or the latest this and that. And there was a stand there by the homeopaths, and we asked them. They didn't know who we were, and I went and I asked them. I said, "I hear you can use homeopathy to vaccinate your children." And they said, "Oh yes, yes, you can do that. We're not supposed to tell you, but you can do that." So we blew the whistle on that. We had a news release, and we got on the radio, and we just blasted them for daring to tell parents that they could use magic sugar water to vaccinate their children against deadly diseases.
Nice, nice work. So yeah. You're pretty familiar with the kind of stuff that we deal with in the United States. What would you say are some of the major differences? Like, what do we have here that is just conspicuously absent in Australia? Or on the other side, what kind of pseudosciences or true believers do you have in Australia that we would not be familiar with in the United States?
I can't think of anything, honestly. The thing you have that we don't is a huge population. So anything that happens over there happens a lot. When you have conventions, they're big conventions. When you have an interest group in a small area, it's a big group because of the huge population of the United States. But, I mean, really, we have all the same things you guys have. We have the anti-vaccination people, the cancer cures, the water diviners, the water witches. I think that's probably the one thing we have possibly a little more, simply because a lot of Australia is dry. And water diviners are usually in demand.
But otherwise, it's pretty much what you're saying. It's the same stuff. It's just.
I think so. Look, I mean, apart from the population difference and the fact that we like to play cricket, we're just another first world modern country.
Right. And that's consistent with things I've read about some specific pseudosciences where they tend to spread along linguistic and cultural lines. So English-speaking countries do tend to get all the same type of stuff, like crop circles spread to English-speaking countries, which, of course, if it was actually a UFO phenomenon, why would it do that, you know, as opposed to a cultural phenomenon? So I guess I shouldn't be surprised that you're saying that. But what about the Australian Aborigines? In this country, there is a resurgence of interest and belief in Native American mysticism and spirituality, which is riding along the coattails of interest in just Native Americans. So I guess, you know, people think that for whatever reason, because they're another culture, they were downtrodden, that their superstitions and their mysticism is okay. Is the same kind of thing happen with the Aborigines in Australia?
You know, not that I have ever heard. You hear stories sometimes about how the Aborigine people here supposedly have strange mystical connections with each other or the land. But honestly, I don't think anything's ever come to the desk of the Australian skeptics. So not that I am aware of. And if they do, they certainly don't come up and make claims and try to win our $100,000 prize, which is very similar to the James Randi $1 million prize.
No energy vortices to report by the Aborigine folk or anything like that?
Afraid not. No, they're pretty quiet.
Here. Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
No, they're pretty quiet when it comes to that. I think they've got more important things to concentrate on, like their own standards of health and education and social issues. I think that would be a little bit too frivolous.
Hey, Richard. Now, Randy did a big stunt. I don't remember what decade he did it, but I was with his friend Jose, and they did that psychic stunt where they fooled the media.
Carlos.
Yep. Now,
oh, yes.
All right. First off, just for our audience, do you remember when he did that?
Not off the top of my head. It would have been the mid-80s.
Yeah, I think it was the 80s. Do you remember when he did that?
I remember. Oh, I remember it very well.
Well, tell us about it, because I want like a first-hand perspective on what it was like to be, you know, living in the country and like reading the news.
It was 1988, by the way.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca. First-hand perspective. Now, I was not involved with Australian Skeptics at this stage, so I was simply an audience person, a citizen, and this was all happening. Well, we had channeling was popular in that era of the 80s. Mm-hmm. People would come out and put on funny voices and channel. The first time I heard about this was on one of the nightly news magazine type shows where they said, and making news in America, there's this channeler called Carlos, and they showed clips of Carlos. And then he's coming to Australia, and it got more and more publicity. But what really did it was this guy, Jose Alvarez, mm-hmm. appeared on one of the morning shows. It was Today or something like that, very similar to the Today Show in the United States, and threw water over one of the hosts and stormed off the set. Well, that was just priceless publicity. Then everybody wanted to know about Carlos and his channeling, and they booked the Sydney Opera House and they filled up the auditorium there, and he gave his channeling. But of course, all, as we know, behind the scenes directing Jose what to say through an earpiece was James Randi, and it was all a con. And when it was revealed that it was a con, the media turned savage upon the 60 Minutes program, which arranged it, and a good friend of ours, Richard Carlton, who sadly died last year. And they went really, really savage on him, which was totally missed the point. They'd been fooled. They'd misled the Australian public by not doing proper research. And they didn't blame themselves. They blamed the 60 Minutes and James Randi.
Now, did anybody in the media eventually come out and say what actually happened and really tell the true story and get this point to the public? Or you know, are you just aware of it because you're a skeptic now?
The point of the whole exercise was to show that the media can mislead the public by not doing research and simply jump on any story which is sexy, and they just follow the bandwagon. That was the whole point of the exercise. That was more or less lost because the media, after they've discovered that they were hoodwinked, they made the story that how dare 60 Minutes trick us.
Okay, so it wasn't like a year or two later it kind of worked itself out.
It was exposed on 60 Minutes. It was interesting. There was all this publicity about Carlos, and then the next thing I remember, there was a promotion for 60 Minutes saying, this week on 60 Minutes, Carlos, he's a fake and we can prove it. So, oh, wow, he's a fake and they can prove it.
Got him.
But it was, and then saying, we can prove it because we set it up. Now, I've posted that whole video on... Now, I believe Google videos. If you go to Google and just video Carlos or James Randi, or both, in fact, it would be better. You'll find that video. It's fascinating.
Do you think there are still people who believe in Carlos?
knowing some of the people involved in that industry, I wouldn't be surprised. No, I think I would be surprised. I mean, it was such a total fake, and it was exposed as a total fake. But, you know, after 6 years in this game, I can't be too surprised about what comes along or what people will believe.
I worry about something like what happened with Randi on Carson when he exposed Peter Popoff, and Carson got hundreds of letters from people asking, where can I talk to that televangelist? So I just picture that there are still some people out there like, I wonder whatever happened to that Carlos guy.
Well, maybe not Carlos specifically, but maybe they can think like, oh, well, that Carlos was a fake, but I know someone else who can also do these same things. They're real.
Yeah.
So it must be real.
Now,
right?
But channeling at the time was very popular. I remember other channelers, and I just remember hearing about it. But these days, you scarcely hear about channeling at all. I mean, I'm sure there are people out there still doing it.
Well, there are quite a bit of people that are talking to the dead and talking to pets and stuff like that. I mean, that's
huge. But what I mean by channeling is someone sits there and they shut their eyes and they shake and flutter, and then they start speaking in a funny voice. I am the magic.
I just think it's evolved. You know, it's the flavor of the decade.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, which is also invaluable for us to remember all this and little details like that, because when we talk about it, we can point out to our listeners or our audience or whatever the case may be that if you all remember back in the 80s, this was popular and it came and went. If it was real, it would still be popular and we'd be getting real information and there'd be lots of people doing it. But it was simply the flavor of the month.
Yeah, it's definitely past its peak. So I can hear what you're saying when you said earlier that you're a one-man show. You know, we're all homegrown, just doing this in our precious spare time. But given that, what are your big plans for the future? What do you hope to expand to?
We love to do more Mystery Investigator show. Alinda in the show, who's my partner in the show, and myself. We have other people in the Australian Skeptics who help out from time to time. In fact, when I was swanning around the waters of Alaska with Rebecca, one of my good friends, Peter Bowditch, the Ratbag, helped out with the Mystery Investigator show because we had a booking, and obviously I couldn't fulfill that booking, so he helped out, which I'm enormously grateful for. So any expansion of that show, the more schools we can reach, the better. The Australian Skeptics keep going strong, making our journal every 3 months.
How many members do you have?
I think it's about 2,500 in Australia, and worldwide there are some, I'm not sure.
Do you have regular meetups?
We do. We have Skeptics in the Pub here in Sydney, which is the first Thursday of every month. More details on our website, www.skeptics.com.au. And that's a great opportunity for anybody to come along, have a beer, have a nice dinner, and talk about anything. There's no set topics. You don't even have to talk about skepticism. We usually do talk about skepticism. And it's Sydney's only free spoon bending lessons.
Oh, God.
You haven't gotten kicked out of the restaurant yet for that?
We bring our own spoons. We make it clear to the people we bring our own spoons. But that's enormous fun. So whatever we can do.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. It's cool to have you.
Thank you, Richard.
We definitely have to make the trip down to Australia sometime, and we'll look you up.
Please do. I'm waiting.
Hey, Richard, you have to go to TAM 6.
TAM 6, look, I have every intention to be at TAM 6. I want to be at TAM 6, and if you are there too, I'd love to meet you there.
We will definitely be there, so if you're there, we'll see you.
We'll see you there. Sure.
Party, party, party.
Take care.
Bye.
And now, Randy speaks.
Randy, one of the more despicable con artists that we encounter are faith healers, and you certainly have a lot of experience with them. Can you tell us about some of your experiences with some of the worst faith healers?
Well, let's face it that one of my very first experiences with, I was about to say debunking, but I don't accept that terminology, of course, of investigating these people was with a faith healer who was known as Little David. I encountered him when I guess I'd be about 17 at the time, and I was in Toronto, Canada, where I was born and almost raised, and I was in the company of my good friend Terence Kingsley Lawson, who was a magic buddy of mine. He dragged me to this church on a Thursday afternoon, I seem to recall, when the church was not being used for legitimate church work, if there is any such thing in the world. We saw this man, Little David, and this is a kid about my age, I guess, about 17 at that time, who had been highly touted. He had blonde hair, which we suspected was bleached. No, could that be? Yes, I think it could be. It was sort of reddish blonde, and he was thoroughly made up and such. We hadn't quite experienced him because he was being touted by the preacher out front, who was building the audience up into great expectation. Lawson and myself sat at the on the upper balcony at the extreme left side. From where I sat, I could get a view of a little bit of a rose garden that was outside the church. And I called attention, the attention of Lawson to the fact that we could see Little David adjusting his tie and his shirt and whatnot and sort of fluffing himself up and with a big mirror looking at himself to make sure his hair was exactly right. It was a Thursday afternoon. He wanted to look good. So we were sort of getting a look at him prepared to go on stage, so to speak. And then, to my astonishment, you know, pardon the indelicacy of the observation, Little David decided that it was urinate, and he did so in the rose garden. I think the roses all died instantly. I'm not sure, but I couldn't see from where I was, but I swear they could have. And we thought that was pretty funny that here was this sainted character who was taking advantage of the Rose Garden for purposes other than what it was designed for. In any case, he did manage to straighten himself up, and when they announced, here he is, little David, and he roared on stage like a rock star. Now, we didn't have rock stars in those days, but we had other stars of various kinds. I'm sure that they all took lessons from him, or he took lessons from them. I'm not sure. And he burst out on the stage and started to screech and hoop and holler and hallelujah and carry on. And he did some apparent healings. We were highly suspicious of the healings, as we were sort of prepared to be. And we tried to follow a couple of the healees outside, and we found that they got into the same van and drove off, and we thought maybe they were from a church group, though they might have been plants that he had there, ringers, who would claim to have been healed. In any case, I was quite annoyed by seeing this thing, because it was pretty obvious to me that these people were not genuinely afflicted with any of the diseases they said they had, and they couldn't be instantly healed that way. But it was my first encounter with the faith healers. Now, that tuned me up to the fact that, well, many years later, coming upon people like W.B. Grant and Peter Popoff, of course, who we thoroughly exposed on the Johnny Carson show, as I'm sure you know, they all do the same thing. It's the same razzmatazz. It's the same showmanship. They learn from one another. Catherine Kuhlman, way back, we used to see her on television. I never got to meet Kathy. But she was a similar character, very ethereal, and dressed in, she looked like she was dressed with the curtains, just off the, right off the windows, because it was all filmy, and she looked like Isadora Duncan as she glided around on the stage. As I say, I only saw her on television, but she was typical of a certain class of these people, the old evangelist type that wanted to dress in a spiritual fashion and use their so-called powers to heal people left and right. Now, the stories about the faith healers that I could give you are rather numerous. Most of them are expressed in my books and in my one book called The Faith Healers, strangely enough. But that book and my other books really need to be upgraded and updated, because so much has happened in the field since. The fact that Peter Popoff was using a little hearing device in his ear to intercept broadcasts from his wife, who was backstage and was monitoring the place by television, by video, that is, shows that the faith healers and the rest of the scam artists out there have moved up a little bit, not very much, but a little bit in their use of technology. I think that people like Catherine Kuhlman and the Holy Paul, I think was his name. That was an interesting one. I must get back to that in a moment. Have used some technology along the way. But let me tell you about this fellow named Paul. Someplace in California, I've forgotten where it was, somebody took me to a service, and we stayed in the balcony and observed him down on the floor, and we thought that he was probably using a radio intercept, and then we discovered inadvertently what the radio intercept was. His wife was introduced on the stage with their current baby. She wandered up into the balcony. She was walking back and forth with the baby and joggling the baby the way mothers do to keep a baby quiet and satisfied. And very interesting, she would pause every now and then and consult a pad that she had underneath the baby, like a stenographer's pad with notes on it. And I determined to get close to her, and I snuck up behind a column and listened to what she was saying to the baby. And she was saying things like, his name is Sam, and he's in the third row with the red and white shirt. So what she was doing was transmitting to her husband on stage. She had all the notes that she'd gathered about the victims that they were about to fleece, and she was broadcasting by talking to the baby. Now, that was a pretty interesting bit of misdirection. You know, you can't fault a mother for cooing to her baby, but she was transmitting information to Paul. David Paul was his name. There have been so many gimmicks like this, but they have not used technology except with this sole exception, so far as I know.
Randy, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
It's time for
Science or fiction?
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are genuine and one is fictitious, fake, and fraudulent. And then I challenge my rogues gallery of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And you all can play along at home. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yes.
Ready.
Ready, no, Steve. Let's do
okay.
it.
Okay. Now, if you recall, last week, I stumped all of you.
You did.
I did. Yep. First time in a long time.
Just barely.
And Bob was absolutely hilarious.
Bob was beside himself.
I'll be playing the role of Bob tonight.
Okay. So we'll see how you do this week. First news item. New study shows that women with anorexia nervosa actually experience the taste of food differently than normal controls. Item number two. A computer model demonstrates how tolls can actually decrease travel time for drivers. And item number three, researchers have developed a device that uses stem cells to identify terrorists in crowded public locations, such as airports. Evan, go first.
Oh, no. Study showing that women with anorexia nervosa experience taste of food differently than normal controls. Sure. I know my father, who suffered with some diseases in his life, had problems. I mean, anorexia wasn't one of them, but he did have things that affected the how he tasted his food and that they tasted differently. So I think that's totally plausible. The computer model demonstrating how tolls can actually decrease travel time for drivers. And then the third one was researchers developing a device using stem cell to identify terrorists in crowded public locations. You know, I think that I won't be surprised if that one is the fiction, but I'm going to go with number two, the computer model demonstrating tolls decreasing travel times is fiction.
Okay.
It's just my gut feeling.
Okay. Jay?
Well, number two, the second one about the decreasing travel time for drivers, I hope that you can answer these questions. For all drivers or some drivers?
All drivers.
Because my initial thought was if you have one of those devices that allows you to drive right through.
No, it's not. It's not benefiting some at the expense of others. It's all drivers.
Okay. Is this like a study of actual drivers, like that are driving today through tolls, or a possible technique that can?
It's a computer model.
It's a computer model.
So it's a possible technique that they're speculating on.
Sure.
Or you don't want to answer that.
It's a computer model. I think that speaks for itself.
I think you're being, evasive
coy
here. Okay. That's interesting. And I can't see that being the reverse. I can't see you doing the old switcheroo on that one. Women, anorexic women actually taste, and it's women, too. You say it's actually women, not just people that have that are anorexic. Experience taste of food differently than normal controls. That's very interesting. I could see that. That makes sense. I'm going to have to... All right, I'll just go with my gut reaction. I'm going to take the last one. The researchers have devised a way to identify terrorists by their stem cells. That one is the big one.
Okay, Rebecca?
That one, the stem cells and the terrorism, that sounds absurd, but there's no way in hell that tolls decrease travel time. I don't care what that computer model is doing. There's no way. So I'm going to go with that as fiction.
Okay. Bob? Oh, wait. Bob's not here tonight.
Oh, crap.
Wait, I'll do Bob. Ready? Here we go. Here's Bob.
Now, we're running long, Jay. We don't have time.
It would have been a good bit.
Okay. So let's take these in order. First one, new study shows that women with anorexia nervosa actually experience the taste of food differently than normal controls. You all agree that that one is science, and that is science. It does kind of make sense. So anorexia nervosa is a psychiatric disorder in which the sufferers believe that they are overweight when they're not. So they have a so-called dysmorphic body image. And they also become obsessed with losing weight. They will restrict their caloric intake. They'll exercise obsessively. And they just always want to get thinner, thinner, thinner. About 10% of people who suffer from this actually die, starve to death as a result of the disorder.
Wow, that many? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yep, very, very high percentage. It's mostly women, and this study was all in women, which is why I said women. This is a functional MRI study. the fMRI study is just taken off. It's a wonderful tool. So you can actually look at the brain function in real time. And what they found was, you know, there of course there are centers in the brain that tell that give you the experience of pleasure eating certain foods, so-called pleasurable foods. There's a certain positive emotional response to eating certain foods, like sweet things, for example. And they looked at women with anorexia and women who do not suffer from that so-called normal controls, either consuming something which is sweet or just water, something with no taste. And the women with anorexia, in response to the sweet test, had a decreased response in that part of their brain that would normally be functioning and giving the pleasurable emotional reaction to food. So this is consistent with the clinical observation that individuals with anorexia avoid normally pleasurable food, and they fail to appropriately respond to hunger and other cues that should make them eat.
So did they only do women for a particular reason?
The study was only in women. The study was only in women for whatever reason. Okay. Probably just because it's easier to recruit that, and then rather than having one or two guys in the study, they just did it all in women. I suspect, which is a recruitment
issue. Because I feel like, I think I've read some statistics that say that anorexia is a growing problem among men, so I'd be interested to see if it's the same thing with them.
Yeah, no, that's correct, and whenever that happens, the question is it really increasing among men, or are we just recognizing
it?
Yeah, is it just increasingly diagnosed among men? And it is, and it's mainly male athletes, especially in those sports where being lean is a competitive advantage. And you know, then that all sorts of questions get raised by that. Is it a subset? Is it the same disorder as anorexia, or is there a different sort of psychological process going on? Is it more of the competitiveness? Although anorexics tend to be competitive too, so there's a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. And in this study, you know, the questions that come to mind are: what's the cause and what's the effect? Is there a disorder in this part of the brain that's causing them to be anorexic, or after years of the anorexic lifestyle and obsessing with losing weight, did they condition themselves to have a negative reaction to caloric food, sweet food? You know, the brain is plastic. It can change in response to conditioning. So, we'll have to see further studies to see, you know, to answer these sub-questions that come up. But very interesting. And again, I'm constantly marveling at how wonderful a tool the functional MRI scan is. Number two, a computer model demonstrates how tolls can actually decrease travel time for drivers. Rebecca and Evan, you thought this one was fiction. Jay, you thought this one was science. And this one is science.
Ooh.
Oh, come on.
It is.
There's
good
no
work,
way
Jay.
Well,
yeah, this is interesting. It's one of those ones where you're like, huh, I wonder how that's possible. What they modeled was using different costs for the toll over different times, so staggering the cost of the toll so that it would be cheaper to go at certain times than at other times, and they can use that in order to persuade people to travel at different times so the traffic gets spread out and you get fewer traffic jams and the traffic time gets reduced for everybody.
So people would alter their driving behaviors based on a lower toll rate?
That's
I would
exactly
doubt it.
That seems I don't know about
no,
that.
Evan, yeah, no, Evan, I have an anecdote for you. I know a guy that actually will drive like 15 miles to go get gas that's 3 cents cheaper a gallon.
Reminds me of a Mad magazine I saw. They were spoofing the Dukes of Hazzard who drove to California because gas was 3 cents cheaper per gallon.
Oh, so, Mad Magazine. It's
people will do Mad stuff magazine like that.
Who won't you
spoof? And then think of it, Evan, what if it only affects 20% of the people? There you go.
That could have a significant effect on traffic jams, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a Dutch researcher, Dusica Joksimovic, and he developed a simulation model that helped policymakers to estimate consequences of various toll charges. And so he developed a sort of staggered, you know, toll charge model, which significantly reduced travel time. And interesting. So, you know, traffic and tolls and whatnot is a perfect question for computer models. It actually works quite well. It reminds me of another computer model of traffic that showed how, again, very counterintuitive, that adding an additional bridge in the pattern of a city's traffic actually increased travel time, the average travel time. So it had an unintended consequence. You would think, oh, there's another bridge. People can spread out their driving over. They have more options. But it actually, you know, shunted people in such a way that it caused more traffic jams and increased the average travel time. So,
plus bridges freeze in cold weather and you have to go slower over them. So I can see that happening.
It's interesting. You know, the bottom line is that traffic can be very complicated, and there could be unintended consequences to manipulating variables in traffic. But it's a problem that is essentially perfectly suited to computer modeling. So this is a good tool to develop.
Cool.
Which means that researchers have developed a device that uses stem cells to identify terrorists in crowded public locations such as airports is fiction. Although I know you're going to say you read the title of the article and didn't read the article, because the article makes it sound, the title, the headline makes it sound exactly like what I just said, but that's not what the study showed. Right.
I don't have time to read whole articles this week, okay, Steve?
So my plan worked perfectly. The headline is New Use for Stem Cells Found in War on Terrorism. But it's not finding terrorists. It's a device that uses stem cells to sniff for chemical bombs.
Well, yeah, and the terrorist who's holding it.
No, but it's not picking out the terrorist from a crowd. It's just for finding chemical weapons.
Yeah, but how else are you going to find a terrorist? Come on.
Non sequitur.
George Bush must be kind of...
You are splitting hairs there, because...
Oh, come on.
Detecting a terrorist as opposed to detecting what the terrorist is carrying?
So you're saying that terrorists are defined by the fact that they have chemical weapons on their person?
No, I think by the fact that they are about to do harm to people is how they are defined.
So George Bush must be in a crisis mode right now with this. You know, he's against stem cell research, but he wants to find terrorists and snuff them out, so...
There was that very poignant irony, and I think that's probably what they were going for in the headline. Stem cells to fight the war on terror. that is quite ironic.
I call shenanigans. I think
people and bombs are different things.
Rebecca, every time you get beat, it's always the same thing. I have partial credit. I call shenanigans. I can't come. It's like,
that was a poorly worded question.
To identify terrorists in a crowded public location is very different than to identify chemical weapons. Okay, Evan.
Puzzle time.
I understand there's a little bit of trouble with the skeptical puzzle, the new one for this week. It's still a work in progress.
It is still a work in progress because, as I promised several weeks ago, that I would perform a puzzle in limerick mode for everyone.
So you're telling us we're going to get that next week?
Yes, you will have the limerick next week.
Awesome.
I do promise that for you all.
Okay, but why don't you tell us the answer to last week's puzzle?
Yep. Well, actually, I'll reread the puzzle first and then tell you the answer. A scientist worth $10.64 believed he discovered it, and he claimed it was faster than Hermes. But despite Poseidon's discovery, it could not be found the same way. In the end, a scientist worth $1.23 proved the first scientist was wrong. What was it? And the answer was, in fact, the planet, the fictional planet, Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, think back to your history/science classes, in which it was thought in the 19th century that there was perhaps a planet inside the orbit of Mercury. Mm-hmm. That was having an unaccounted for effect on its orbit around the sun, one that they couldn't calculate using straight mathematics. And a scientist by the name of French scientist Urbain Le Verrier, back in the 19th century, he was the discoverer of the planet Neptune using mathematics and astronomical observations to imply that Neptune had to exist because it was having an effect on Uranus's orbit, and it turned out to be correct. So he tried using that same approach to explaining the orbit of Mercury, and it didn't work. It was off until our good friend Mr. Albert Einstein came along with his general theory of relativity and plugged in the figures, and it explained exactly the orbit of Mercury, and there was no more need for the planet Vulcan at that point. But how does the whole $10.64
Yeah, that was the bit I couldn't figure out. What is that?
Yeah. So, and interesting, you know, someone who, their first post on the website, Rogue Combine, his first post, he says, "Hi, I'm new." And he says, both of those guys, Verrier and Einstein, appeared on banknotes. Verrier was on the French 50-franc bill, which if you were to calculate it in at least the rate I calculated last week when I plugged it in, it was worth 50 francs, is $10.64. And Einstein's on the Israeli 5-shekel bill, which is worth $1.23.
Very tricksy.
Rogue Combine got the dollars and cents part. However, our good friend Kevin from the boards was the one who actually guessed Vulcan first. So we'll have a pair of winners this week. Kevin and Rogue Combine together came up with the correct answer. So congratulations to both of them.
Good work.
Good work. And next week, a limerick just for all of you.
I can't Ooh. Wait.
I can't wait either.
I'm tingling with excitement.
It'll be limerific.
Limtastic.
All right, Jay Fuss, do you have a yes, quote sir. To close out the week for us?
I have a quote. I have a quote from someone that's alive.
Wow.
Which is interesting. This is a quote from Evelyn Fox Keller, is an American physicist, author, and feminist, and is currently a professor of history and philosophy of science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
I've heard of that place.
She says, "To know the history of science is to recognize the mortality of any claim to universal truth." Evelyn Fox Keller. Just think over that one.
Thank you, Jay. A very interesting quote.
Good but point. Is it? Did you think about it like I asked you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Okay, that's all.
So this chick is still alive, so maybe can we interview her sometime?
I actually, you know, while I'm going through quotes and I'm reading a bunch of them, and there's a ton of ones out there, and I usually like to read about who it is if I find one that's interesting. So I did do some reading on her, and she is very interesting.
Oh, something to keep in mind.
Okay.
Well, thank you all again. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Doctor.
Steve.
Good
Thanks,
show.
Steve.
Congratulations
welcome back,
again.
Rebecca. Yeah, Rebecca. Congratulations.
It's good
Thank
stuff,
you.
Girl.
One quick announcement for this week. The Skeptic's Guide has just started a Skeptic's Guide blog, the Rogues Gallery, the official blog of the Skeptic's Guide. We plan on having a daily entry. We have 7 authors contributing to this blog. All of the rogues, of course, Bob, Jay, Evan, Rebecca, myself included, Mike from SGUfans.net, and an old friend of ours, John Blumenfeld, who used to run the Connecticut chapter for the New England Skeptical Society and wants to get back involved with skepticism, is going to take one day a week as well. So we'll have an entry by a different author every day of the week. So give it a look. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.
Problems proof endless.